Good morning, men. Welcome to another podcast in our series, Short People in Deep Water. This one was recorded live on Saturday, the 19th of January, recorded at our Saturday morning study at Morningstar Fellowship. This morning, we're going to be looking at a topic that I'm reasonably certain every single man will be able to relate to. Remember from the past 2 weeks, if you've been following along, that the series, Short People in Deep Water, deals with how do we cope with things in our life when they're beyond our ability to manage, when we are literally thrown in to something and we feel overwhelmed by it. And it's usually a difficult thing. It could be an opportunity, but it's disguised as a difficulty, and we're exploring how we deal with those things. We dealt first with the reality that difficult situations are going to come into our life. That was Jesus' promise to us. Then in the second week, we looked at the reality that sometimes we are alone in that difficulty in the end, and that we need to learn to encourage ourselves in the Lord, as the scripture says. Well, how do we do that? This morning we're going to look at that in a little bit more detail. That is the how do we encourage ourselves in the Lord aspect of being in deep water. And then we're going to move into the next topic, which is what happens when we're the source of our own difficulty. It's one thing when the enemy is outside the gate. It's one thing when the difficulties in life come to us through no fault of our own. But boy, isn't it different when we're the source of the trouble. And how do we deal with that? Is God still on our side? When we get ourselves into the bind, is God still on our side? Is God still with us? And I think we can all struggle with this. So as you listen along, feel free to pause the playing and meditate on what you're hearing. Maybe take some notes if you're listening somewhere where that's an opportunity for you, if that's possible for you. And I hope this will be a great encouragement to you. See you next week. That our desire is to avoid tribulation so that we can stay the way we are. So our prayer to God is, please make my problem go away. Jesus' promise to us is exactly the opposite. It is, I'm going to perhaps leave you right in the middle of that tribulation, but I'm going to give you the peace to get through it. So, two components. Tribulation is inevitable. Peace is optional. And the second thing that falls right along with that, our desire is to make our world manageable. Please, God, make my world fit my present abilities. God's answer is, I'm going to give you peace while I grow you into the situations of life. So that's week one summed up nicely. I hope that is very memorable. Because when you get to the moments in your life where your life is really difficult, you're not going to remember a five-point sermon, honestly. You're going to remember one or two principles that are going to carry you through the tough times. So we review this not because I need to review this again. We review this because I hope that this stuff is going to stick. Because one of the other things that we talked about, well, it is that first point. Tribulation is inevitable. How many of you think right now you're going through something? I mean, without exaggerating, I mean, you don't have to. It's good. Doesn't it feel good to keep your hand down? No, right now I am not going through something. That's a good thing.
Yes, it is.
All right. Last week we looked at... Well, why don't you tell me? The big point, the big principle.
Find your strength in God.
Find your strength in God at various times and places. When I am in the midst of deep water, I'm going to be alone. We use the story of David coming back from his non-soldiering experience, he and his men, to find everything that they own gone. Their wives and their kids taken, their livestock and all their wealth plundered and taken, their city burned to the ground. And what was the response of David's men? Well, they all sat down and cried. They wailed, they moaned, they mourned. They did all that together first. And then what was the second response?
To blame David.
So at that moment, there's a real isolation. You know, this is your fault, David. Sooner or later, and this is the way I summed it up in this week's email, which maybe you've gotten by now, maybe you haven't. Sooner or later, the friends are going to come, go home. Sooner or later, the time is going to come when everybody who promised you some hope, they're going to leave because they see it's hopeless or they don't understand how to do something with it. Sooner or later, you and your problem are going to be alone. So at that moment, you have choice number two. And that is, am I going to walk through this alone and see if I can gut it out in my own strength? Or am I going to, and the phrase that we use, coming straight from that text in Samuel, am I going to encourage myself in the Lord? And if I'm going to encourage myself in the Lord, how do I do that? And we're going to take the review, and we're going to move from review, and I'm going to expand a little bit on that review today. So if you would, turn over to the Hebrews, the 13th chapter. Thank you. And while you're finding the 13th chapter, we'll start at the first verse. The 13th chapter, yeah. In general, the book of Hebrews is pretty eloquently 13. Hebrews, In general, the book is eloquently written. It's well thought out. It's almost poetic in nature, the way most of the book is written. Remember, Hebrews contains the faith chapter, where he goes on and he's pretty flowery and elaborate in his description of people of faith. And this 13th chapter is almost like an afterthought. It's sort of like if you've had a weekend with somebody and you've had plenty of time to interact and talk, and it's like you're getting in the car and then there's three or four things that you remember that you want to tell somebody right as you're ready to pull out the driveway. And the 13th chapter feels a lot like that. There's all these add-ons that, oh, I want to remember to tell them this and I want to remember to tell them that. So we're going to start with the first verse only so that I can just lead you into this important part of it. Let brotherly love continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unaware. And remember those who are in prison, as though in prison with them, and those who are mistreated, since you are in the body. Let marriage be held in honor among all, and let the marriage bed be undefiled, for God will judge the sexually immoral. So in just a matter of a couple of sentences, we've gone from showing hospitality to make sure that you don't commit adultery. I mean, he's just one point after another, and that's why there's really no context for what we're going to look at when we jump down to verse 5. Keep your life free from the love of money, and be content with what you have. For he has said, and this is the important part, I will never leave you nor forsake you. All right, so what do those two phrases have to do with each other? Keep your life free from the love of money, for he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Okay, so that's a promise. But it's also a choice on our part. Let's think a little bit bigger picture here. Did you want to say something?
Well, we do. But the chips are down.
Okay, let's take...
I want comfort when the chips are down, so I'm going to go buy something to make me feel better, or I'm going to go get...
No, I'm not even sure that's what I would say that he's saying.
Well, no, I'm going to make it from David to this.
Let me sum it up differently. Keep your life free from the love of self-sufficiency. For he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. What is the guy's security in the first thing? It's money. If I have enough money, have you ever felt that? If I had more money, I could fix my problem? Well, sometimes that's true, right? But in general. As a matter of fact, this past week, on Thursday night, I did a study with a couple of guys, and one of the verses said something like this. The wealth of the rich is their fortified city. And they imagine that no one can scale its walls. Now just take that verse and set it side by side with this. The wealth of the rich is their fortified city, and they imagine that no one can scale its walls. What's that saying? Well, it might be an untruth, but that's not what they're saying. They're saying that that's not what Solomon is saying. He's saying, in the minds of these people, they say, if I accumulate enough wealth, it will save me from it. Yes, it is an untruth. Have you ever lived that way?
Some days still
do. Okay, so it might be an untruth, but that's completely irrelevant. Do we live that way? Yes, we do. We find our security in what we build up for ourselves because we'd rather, and what's the ultimate message there? I would rather trust myself than God because I believe in the end that I am more trustworthy than God. And if I am more trustworthy than God, then I really need to get busy building a bigger fortified city because who knows how big the problem is going to be that's going to come down the road and face me. So the more fortified my city, the more wealth that I have accumulated, the more likely it is that the walls of my fortified city will be unscalable. So let's just pretend that one or another of us, sometime in our lifetimes, has thought that. Let's just pretend that even though we are deeply spiritual men and would never resort to such divisive and secular means, that we know somebody that's like that. Okay, so if that were true for your neighbor, how much time would he spend pursuing wealth? Of course it would. So now, we're going to move the focus from your neighbor to you. Have you ever been preoccupied with life to such an extent that you almost find it difficult to connect deeply with God?
I don't know if I can't speak for anybody else, but I have times finding even now, like during the week, that happens to me because I get so consumed with what I work as much overtime as I can and get as much money as I can that I forget what's really important.
I didn't have to promote that because everybody who goes to the same thing we do, somebody's trying to study something. TV. It's a means of advertising. It's entertainment.
It's just it's a little money on the basis of it.
Okay. So I don't want to. Now there's two tracks that we're sort of running on in parallel here, and I want us not to run the one rail, and the one rail is materialism. I don't want us to focus on materialism this morning. That's its own trap. What I want us to focus on is where do we get our security? When the chips are down, what are we going to rely on? And I think it is really. Can you lean all of your weight on two things at the same time? Wow, nobody's going to disagree with me. Yeah, I'm sure you will find some way that you can put the chairs next to each other, angle them correctly, and you really could lean on both chairs at the same time. Are you going to dispute?
Exactly. The weight is too much. One's going to break the other, and you're going to fall in that direction. You know, like fall.
Isn't that a great illustration? And so what you're saying is that really? Do you want to stand up here for a while? So I like the way you did that because what you said is that we tend to want to hedge our bet. So we're going to pretend that we lean on God while we kind of lean on money just in case God fails us, we'll have some money, or just in case money fails us, we'll have some God. Whichever seems to let out on us first, we'll still have the other. It often does. I'm not saying it always does. We're not saying, look, I have hope for us that we're growing spiritually.
But what are you talking about? You're leaning on God. leaned up against, you've got that thing going. Your faith is going to go first. And when it does, it all comes down. When your faith breaks, it all comes down. Not one thing.
Yeah.
That's how
and we come back right back to that thing that we taught about the other week, where we say the house that's built on sand is sooner or later going to wash away. It'll survive some storms, it'll survive a minor shower, but it may not survive the ultimate storm.
I don't trust God because I can't see his pockets. I can't see how deep his wallet is. That's why I don't trust him. I know how deep my wallet is. I know how many greenbacks are in there. So I know.
And remember that the money is just one way that we find security in ourselves. I mean, it's all the things. It's our connections. It's our power. It's our influence. It's that whole array of things that we tend to line up and we say, these things that I have made with my own hands are my security versus I can trust in God. And we've all heard this phrase, you never know if God is all you need until God is all you have. And we've heard it said different ways, but how true is that? It's only after all that second 2x4 has been kicked out that you find out if the first 2x4 was really trustworthy. All right. So, verse number 6. So we can confidently say, and incidentally, this is all still review. I don't know how review it takes so long, but this is still review. And the premise was, there are times when I am alone, and I need to be able to encourage myself. If you want to make fun of me back there, could you all do it out loud so I can hear you? No? It's not you? It's him. Well, I should have expected that from him. Okay, so I will never leave you nor forsake you. So we can confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? All right, so I'm going to say this as clearly as possible. Each human being in this room needs to have a small personal scriptural library of go-to texts so that when life is extremely difficult, you have some area, some texts that you can go to and you can soak in them. You ever gone out and done a really hard day's work and it's like, I mean, typically, probably most of us take a shower, but have you ever just been thoroughly exhausted and there's nothing like a good hot soak in a tub to free up the muscles and relax? And it's like, there are times when we are spiritually beat down, when we are spiritually exhausted, you need something in which you can soak your spirit to rejuvenate it. You need a few texts that you can go to. So we're going to go to one of them now, and it's the text from which this is taken. This, the Lord is my helper, I will not fear, what can man do to me, is a quote taken directly from Psalms. We're going to go back there to Psalm 118. Actually, we're going to go 5 through 9. And this is just an excellent text for what do you do when you need to encourage yourself in the Lord. We're going to start at the first verse. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for He is good. His steadfast love endures forever. Remember one of the big questions we talked about in week one? When you're going through deep stuff, what is one of your temptations in mind? To say, I must be going through this because God doesn't love me anymore. I must be going through this because I've done something to make God displeased with me, and this is my punishment, and I deserve this. And you may never put those thoughts into direct words, but they kind of run like a background track in your mind. Maybe God's angry with me. Maybe I've done something, and God's doing something to teach me. Maybe God's punishing me. Read the verse again. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for He is good, for His steadfast. And let's just insert some other words there. His reliable, His steady, His sure in all times, His never wavers, love endures forever. Anybody remember the working definition we use for love here? Come on, take a bold step. Guess if you have to. Pretend that you've learned something in the last number of years that you've been here. Okay, the active and diligent effort to watch out for the good of another human being. I am intentional, I am deliberate in looking out for, in watching out for your best interest. That's love. Got that? Y'all forget it by next week, right? But try to remember something that we talk about here.
Agape love?
Yes. But we need to stop. I mean, it's nice to use Greek terms, but I just want to make this so memorable. You got to get this. This is God's commitment to us, the active, the intentional commitment to our well-being.
I'm more concerned about your comfort than mine.
So, oh, give thanks to the Lord, for He is good. His steadfast, active, and intentional commitment to our well-being endures forever. And that's precisely how we need to encourage ourselves. When you sit down and the doubts are going through your mind, and maybe I deserve this, and maybe God's angry with me, or maybe God's just, that's it, I've screwed up so many times, God is not going to bail me out one more time. And you've got to have go-to verses like this to remind you of this. All right, so then we get a couple of verses going where, I don't know if any of you spend any time in sort of a more liturgical church where somebody reads something from the front and then the congregation responds with something. And so here it is. So we'd have like the guy at the front saying, "Let Israel say." And then the congregation says, "His steadfast love endures forever." "Let the house of Aaron say." And again, "His steadfast love endures forever." "Let those who fear the Lord say. His steadfast love endures forever." So what's the message? His steadfast love endures forever. Why do we say it so many times? Because we forget it so many times. Because we doubt it so many times. Because quite honestly, it seems as if from our human perspective, that life disproves that. Doesn't it? It calls it into question. And we doubt it.
I don't have a point of reference for this. I'm a human being. My best point of reference for love is my mom. That's my best, not actually Barbie. Now my point of reference is Barbie. And she knows how to do that way better than I do. She knows how to love unconditionally way more than I do. Very rarely does she ever speak out against anybody. When I hear stuff like that, I think, okay, because I'm task-driven. I'm very logical. When I hear that, I think, okay, I have to be like that. How do I do that? How do I even wrap my head around that? I love that it endures forever. I mean, I've been divorced twice for crying out loud. In my life, it doesn't seem to. My dad's divorced twice. In my life, love doesn't seem to.
Okay. You're asking this from the exact opposite question. We're reading this and saying God's steadfast love endures forever, and you're saying, how do I have love for others that endures forever? How do you know that? Is you have to experience over a period of time, and until you have personally experienced it, you have to rely on other trustworthy people or other trustworthy sources.
And that brings me back to the beginning. Is you said when I need to feed myself, when I need to take that good soap, oftentimes I call somebody else for that good soap, or I'll get with you and say I'm done, and you'll remind me of a few things.
This is why Brother Jim is in such bad shape, because I'm the best he's got in life. So maybe somebody else needs to call him someday.
That's not true. I'm not in bad shape. But when I am in one of those states, I can't do that for myself. I know how to do is to call somebody and say, man, what a day. You wouldn't believe it. And they will remind me of.
Okay, so let's move on. And again, the theme here for right now, we're still sort of in this review, but I'm unpacking the review a little bit more. When I am in the midst of my aloneness and my deep water, how do I encourage myself? So let's read on. Out of my distress I called on the Lord. The Lord answered me and set me free. So you project yourself right into that situation when you are in the distress. And then this acts like a future promise. Out of my distress I called on the Lord, and the Lord answered me and set me free. The Lord is on my side. I will not fear. What can man do to me? The Lord is on my side as my helper. I shall look in triumph on those who hate me. And then finally, it is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in man. It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in princes. So just a good, nice, concise reminder, something you can refer back to again and again, because not only do we have new troubles awaiting us in the future, but we're forgetful. And you guys are great evidence of that. I can ask you something this week that we talked about for a half an hour last week, and you're proof every week that we need to review. Do you have to be so enthusiastic with your thumbs up, really? Yeah. One final reminder, and again, pushing further back into the Old Testament, and this is where this thought originates with Joshua. You don't need to turn there, but Joshua 1, 5th verse, this is God talking to Joshua, "No man will be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I was with Moses, I will be with you." What an encouraging thought, if you could really believe that. And I say if, because the chances are that we're going to fully embrace and believe that, boy, that comes over a period of time. We just don't do that. We just don't say to ourselves, "I firmly believe that God is with me." Thanks, Art. All right. Well, so much for review. Now, let's get into the material for the day. And I think we're kind of doing this a little bit out of order. There were a couple of things that I wanted to cover personally. For a couple of weeks, Marcos is going to be leading in February while I'm away. So, because we got that coming up and because of the breakfast, I would not have preferred to take this topic right now, but I think it's something that everybody can relate to, and I thought it was so important I wanted to do it. Sometimes we're in deep water because we're sick. It's not our fault. A relationship breaks up and it's not our fault. But sometimes, and this is where we struggle with doubts about God, sometimes the deep water that we're in is of our own making. I got myself into this mess. So I believed everything about God's promises. I believed everything about the whole thing as long as it pertained to outside sources came in and afflicted me with bad stuff. But what if I'm the guy who just shot myself in the foot? What do I do with that? What do I think about myself after that? What's my confidence level in myself? What's my natural instinctive response when it pertains to, is God able? I mean, does God just sit there and say, "Well, I guess you learned your lesson now, didn't you?" And again, we never, well, maybe some of us never say those things out loud, but we think them. Those of you in the back end of the room there that are drivers, you have long stretches where you've got nothing but you, the road, and your thoughts. What do you do with those hours of thought? And sometimes we can beat ourselves up with them. So, we're going to turn over to the book of Exodus here. And I don't know why, but I feel obliged to give you a little bit of a breakdown of the scriptures. Maybe it will be helpful. So most of us know that at least the bulk of the books, the first five books of the Bible, Moses is responsible for what we'll say is compiling them. So he puts the main ideas together. They're probably refined during the exile period. They're probably organized a little bit better during the exile period. But at least he is responsible for sort of gathering the basic stuff together. So we say the book of Genesis, everything that Moses collects for the book of Genesis predates him. So if you want to look on a timeline, Moses collects the entire book of Genesis, and it all leads up to this point in Exodus. And then there's a break, and Exodus begins the story of Moses and the people. So, let's just... You know what? I'll just read a little bit. You don't have to follow along with me because it's just going to get too confusing if you're jumping all over the place. Familiar text in Exodus. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. All right, so most of you know the story. The book of Genesis closes with the fact that this group of, roughly speaking, 100 people, a few under 100, they move from the land where there is famine, they move down to Egypt because they can find some food there, they can survive there, and they're invited to stay there. Because Joseph has solved Egypt's problems, because Joseph has become the hero, because Joseph has become a leader, the Pharaoh says, why doesn't your family just live here? They can live out there, there's good land out there, they can care for their sheep, they can do all this, and the people settle in, and they get comfortable, and they stay. And years pass, and generations pass. And so we come to this text now, that I just started to read. Now there arose a new king in Egypt, who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them. Now, how do we know that that's what he says? Because Moses is an insider. Moses has undoubtedly heard these conversations growing up. Now, we don't know that until we read further on and we find out who Moses is. But looking hindsight-wise, we can say that. This was one of the conversations that Moses would have overheard. We got to keep these Hebrews in check. They're completely out of control. And he describes it this way. Lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. So, let's go back to the Deep South 150 years ago. The slaves outnumbered the landowners far and away. But who had the power? The power was held by a few that were educated and had the wealth, and they could control the masses for their own gain. It's a similar situation here. The few with the bucks and the education can control the masses and manipulate them for their own benefit. Therefore they set taskmasters over them, them being the Hebrews, to afflict them with heavy burdens, and they built for Pharaoh store cities, and it goes on and on. And so what it says is, ultimately, well, we think we're going to oppress the Hebrews. We're going to just work them to the point that, and we're guys so we can say this, by the time they get home, the only thing they're going to be interested in doing when they climb into bed is going to sleep. Okay, so maybe we can downgrade the population a little bit by just exhausting them. Well, that doesn't work. And so they have to resort to the next strategy, which is, when you serve as a midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. If it is a daughter, you shall let them live. So the leader's second strategy is, okay, if we can't work them into oblivion, then we're going to start to control the population by killing all the males. Well, why just the males? Well, you can kill the females and accomplish the same thing. Why the males? Huh?
They'll fight.
Remember what one of the threats was that they perceived? That these men, the women aren't going to go out to war, that these men will side with an enemy and rise up against us. They're going to control the male population, even if it costs them a little bit in the labor force, because they feel that this is their security. Now just think about this. Okay, remember what we talked about a few minutes ago? I can either put my trust in myself, my own devices, my own wealth, my own all this, or I can put my trust in God. Maybe we don't think of it this way, but if you were Pharaoh, and you had a large population to control, and you had no trust in God, and you didn't have to give account to a higher authority, What would you do if you were in fear for your life from a people that might outnumber you? You'd take whatever steps were necessary, right? You're the leader of the people. You're going to protect your own people. This is one thing. This is kind of like a sidebar lesson. But when we don't place our confidence... Well, this is great. I got two cups now. When we don't rely on God and reduce ourselves to relying on our own cunning, was the word that was used, we open ourselves up to do just about anything. And humanity has, over the course of the years, proved that when it relies on its own cunning and devices, it will do just about anything. Nothing is out of bounds. Here's the thing. None of us is exempt from that. You may not go out and kill somebody to protect your stuff, but I'm saying all of us in this room. But we'll probably step outside the bounds that God has for us if we rely on our own devices. That's just who we are. That's how we think. All right, so the second component. So I'm going to reduce the male population, therefore they won't be able to fight against me. The second reason why this would be an effective strategy is because there's going to be a bunch of women running around. Okay? So the Egyptian people, even though they wouldn't marry these people, the Egyptian men would take advantage of these people. And what's going to happen? The Hebrews were a pure ethnic group. They prided themselves in that. We're going to create like this half-breed race that's going on there, and we're gradually going to reduce the purity of the Hebrew population as well. That's going to break their pride. So we're going to reduce their male population, and we're going to break their pride, and we're going to do it by killing the male children. The only reason I go through all this is because this is what Moses is born into. When a person writes a story, you learn as much by what they don't say as what they do. Why do they include this story, and why do they omit this story? And we're going to see that in a minute. All right, so chapter 2, and now maybe you want to follow along. Exodus chapter 2. And I'm going to try to read quickly because we have a lot to go through. Now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. And the woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. And the previous text explains why she had to hide the son. When she could hide him no longer, she took him in a basket and made of bulrushes, dabbed it with bitumen and pitch, and she put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank, and his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done with him. Okay, so she can't hide the kid anymore. He's old enough that he's going to start to make noise. Pretty soon he's going to be running around and doing all this stuff, and it's going to be pretty obvious to the Egyptians, say, he's a boy and he don't look like us. Right? Somebody didn't get killed that should have. And so she thinks, maybe I'll just put my kid out there and maybe some Egyptian woman might. And of all people, now remember, Moses is telling this story. In light of what you're going to see, Moses is amazed by how he's protected. The sister stood at a distance to know what would be done with him. Now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, and while her young woman walked beside the river, she saw the basket among the reeds. Okay, so she notices this Hebrew kid floating in a basket, and of all people, it's Pharaoh's daughter. And so the sister runs up then, and I'm trying to do this quickly. Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you? And Pharaoh's daughter says to her, go. So the girl went and called the child's mother. So here's the storyline. It's like, mom puts kid in a basket, floats it on the river. Of all people that come by to bathe that day, it is the daughter of Pharaoh, the leader of Egypt, and she's attracted to the kid and doesn't say, let's drown that little rat. But instead says, what a cool kid, I think I'd like to adopt it. But I'm not nursing. I can't provide the kid with what he needs to eat, and they can't run down to the local mini mart and buy some formula, so we need to find a woman who can nurse this kid. And so the sister says, say, I think I know somebody who could finish that job, and goes home and gets mom. And Moses is like utterly amazed by this set of circumstances. You're going to see why in a little bit. Okay, so here's the story. We are at verse 10. When the child grew older, she, meaning the mother, brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses because she said, I drew him out of the water. Verse number 11. We just read verse number 10. Verse number 11. One day when Moses was grown up, what happened to all that time in Pharaoh's court? Don't you want to know that? This guy grows up in the presence of the leader of Egypt, and he doesn't think it's important enough to tell us one sentence about his life? You can tell a lot about the purpose for a story by what's left out as well as what's included. Nothing is said about Moses growing up. So when Moses writes the book of Exodus, it is more than just history. It is purposeful, selective history to explain to people how a chosen person is protected, prepared, and equipped for a specific mission. Does that make sense? When we read it, we're looking for facts and figures and information and all this stuff, and it's not there. This book is not written to tell us everything about Moses' life. This book is written to encourage us in this simple truth. When God calls you to something, He will protect you. Alright, so the first time Moses is protected, the first deep water, literally the first water that Moses is in, God provides protection. He could have been killed as a baby, but God orchestrates a circumstance that allows him not just to be cared for, but to be cared for and developed as a leader. So now we look at the second circumstance, and this is where it gets personal. What happens when I am the source of my own deep water? One day when Moses was grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. And he looked this way and that, and seeing that no one was looking, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. Okay, so he goes out, he's been developed as a leader, and for some reason he has an attraction to these Hebrew people. He understands that they're his people. And something in him wells up because he senses that he wants to try to make something right here. There's already a call in his life. There's already a purpose for his life. There's already a direction for his life. It's the, I really think I want to make this the mission of my life, but I'm not quite sure how. And so he goes about it probably the wrong way. So his first step in protecting the people is to kill one of the Egyptians, and it soon becomes evident that it's more commonly known than he's aware of, and so it says that he has to run for his life. Here's how he says it. Surely the thing is known. When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. And here is where the second act of care and protection takes place. So now, this is something that Moses clearly got himself into. This is the question. It's the question he asks, and incidentally, the distance from Egypt to Midian is a long way. If I could have a map on the wall, it's like, there's the whole Sinai Peninsula, which is that thing that kind of separates Africa from parts of Asia, and it juts down in there, and the Red Sea splits it. He's got to go all the way across the Sinai Peninsula, cross another part of the Red Sea, and then get over into Midian. Remember what we were just talking about, being alone in the cab of your truck with your thoughts? He's alone with his feet for probably a few months of walking. What do you think every day? There I was. I was in Egypt. I had it made. Someday I was going to be somebody. And here I am, in the desert. And I don't even know if I got enough water to drink for the day. And that would be his conversation with himself, day after day after day. So when it says he sits down at a well, that's a really big deal. I found a spot that's got water. I'm going to sit down there. Now the priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Okay, so the next story is, so I sit down at a well, and out comes somebody, and I'm invited home to dinner. Not only am I invited home to dinner, I'm invited home to stay. I'm invited home to stay, and I'm given a wife. I'm given a family. I'm given a fresh start. I didn't do anything to deserve this. I didn't do anything to earn it. What?
This guy is smart. He was raised in Egypt under the Pharaoh. He's not stupid.
Right.
You can tell the first 10 seconds talking to this guy that he's somebody. I want that from my daughter. Because all these other guys around here are idiots.
Well, that's possible. That's possible.
He makes money. He knows how business works. He knows how to add, subtract. He knows how to write.
But it's also possible that he would have been resented. It's also possible that as a perceived educated... Let's go back to the Deep South. Now, let's say that the wealthy person comes to the slave cabin. How open are the slaves to the wealthy person? Do they say, come on down, have some chitlins with us, let's talk life?
Well, it was exactly kind of said, really. Put him into the situation of being accepted. Because he protected the women.
It demonstrates a level of character that ingratiates the people to him. But still, he is provided for. And he's pleased with that. And he's amazed by it. And remember, just like there's no storyline for the whole time, from the time he's a kid to the time he's an adult, wouldn't you be curious to know what he does while he's walking across the desert? Nothing.
See, I think the reason that's not in there is because if you're a child of the Pharaoh, you know what happens. You spend your whole life in education and in learning and in becoming a great leader. That's what your whole life is going to be. You're a son of Pharaoh. The daughter finds him. She finds a puppy. That's what she did. She said, oh, look, a puppy. Daddy, can I keep it? Okay. Well, you're going to take care of him. Okay, I will. And amazingly enough, it all comes together. You know, it does. But this is a guy who's, like, that's the part that I think about from Moses' story all the time. This guy's educated. He's not stupid. He made a poor choice in the day. And I think that long walk to the Sinai, he's looking over his shoulder. Because the entire Egyptian army wants to know, where is this guy? Somebody's chasing me.
Well, and if...
I can just be perceived.
You're right.
My perception is that they're going to chase me down. They might not even be looking for me. I've gotten a lot further afraid than I do.
Oh. Okay, let me move on here, because, again, we're going to see this idea. And interestingly enough, the people in Moses' life that seem to step in to protect him at unique times tend to be women. Who finds him at the well? The daughters. Who sticks him in the water, who cares for him, who nurses him, who adopts him. They're all women. Now we're going to turn over to Exodus, the fourth chapter. So Moses has already gotten his call. He's going to go back. So he returns home. And he says, I want to go back to Egypt. I want to check on my people. I want to at least see them. I want to meet with them. I want to find out what's going on. And I'm sure he doesn't tell his father-in-law everything that's going on in his mind. But he wants to make it clear. And so he gathers up his wife and his kid, and they leave. At a lodging place on the way, the Lord met with him and sought to put him to death. Well, that's odd. God has just called him. Then Zipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and touched Moses' feet with it and said, surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me. So he let him alone, he meaning God, let Moses alone. It was then that she said a bridegroom, that she called him a bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision. Okay, so Moses is this like displaced person. He's a Hebrew, but he's been adopted out of his Hebrew situation. He used to be an Egyptian, but he had to leave Egypt. He becomes adopted by a Midianite clan and becomes part of that, but now he senses a call back to being one of the Hebrews. What is the covenant that God has with Hebrews, starting with Abraham? It's the circumcision thing. And what's ultimately being said here is, Moses, you got to make up your mind who you're going to be. You got to make up your mind what your identity is going to be. And And this circumcision thing is a once and done deal. You are going to be a Hebrew. You are going to lead your wife and you are going to lead your family according to the way of the Hebrews. And you can almost see this. Notice who does this circumcision? It's the wife. Okay, so suppose you've never heard about... Just place yourself in this situation. Your wife knows nothing about circumcision. She senses that you're in danger one night. So her solution for saving your life is to wake your son up and circumcise him in the middle of the night. Does that seem like a logical salvation strategy? Do you understand what I'm saying? This conversation... Hebrew children are circumcised. Well, you're not doing that to my kid. That conversation has taken place multiple times in the Midianite household. And so finally, this conversation comes to a head. And it's which direction is our family going? One way or another. And finally, the woman steps in and says, okay, I get it. It's going to happen. And again, a woman steps in and helps to secure Moses' future. All right. So we get all that. Now, Exodus, essentially divided into two. We're going back to biblical history. So we got the first half of the book of Moses, or book of Exodus, is Moses' story from the time of his birth through getting to Mount Sinai. That's where the history part stops. The second they get to Sinai, the rest of the book of Exodus concerns itself with God's giving them the law and them building the tabernacle. So the history stops and the law starts. History doesn't really pick up again until you get to the book of Numbers, which is one of those books that nobody reads. It's like, why would we want to read this? Because honestly, if you were writing the book of Numbers, you would not start the book of Numbers the way Moses starts it. You would not start it with lists and inventories and census and all. You would just not start it that way. You would have a gripping tale in the opening chapter because that would make the reader want to go further into the book. So the real history of Numbers doesn't start until about the ninth chapter. So if you look at the ninth chapter, and everything up until this time, even in the book of Numbers, is inventory, and it's more ceremonial law, and it's rules for things. And it says, ninth chapter, first verse, and the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai. So they're still in Sinai. They haven't left Sinai in the first month of the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt. First month, second year, which means that they have now been traveling for a full year. Well, they've been out in the desert for a full year. Let the people of Israel keep the Passover at its appointed time, on the 14th day of this month, at twilight. Okay, so the Passover was... this is the first Passover that they have celebrated outside of Egypt. The first one was the real Passover, the blood on the doorpost, or the lintels, and the delivering angel, or the killing angel, goes over them and all that. So that's the first Passover. This is the second Passover. This is commemorating what really happened. As soon as that's done, it says, we jump over to the 10th chapter here, in the second year, in the second month, on the 20th day of the month, the cloud lifted from over the tabernacle of the testimony, and the people of Israel set out by stages from the wilderness. Sinai is a pivotal moment in their history. And Moses uses this to explain what's going to happen. Because what you're going to see is Moses' next mistake. That's where we're headed with this. That's our theme for the morning. Are my mistakes redeemable? So we're going to talk... Actually, I'm going to check my notes. That seems like a good idea to do now. So, some mistakes, we want to know if we can fix them. Some mistakes are fixable. Some mistakes are what I call redeemable. Some are not, and you just have to learn to live with them. That's it. I've made this choice. I've done this thing. I've shot myself in the foot. Sometimes we cure the foot. Sometimes we cut the foot off. That's the way it is. So some of Moses' mistakes, his anger and his killing the Egyptian, God seems to redeem that. God seems to turn it around. It takes a while. Maybe that was even all part of the plan. Not the killing, but the time. So God uses a bad situation and He turns it around and He allows that to help Moses, to prepare Moses for the next phase of his life. Sometimes we make a mistake and there is no redemption from it. And God is going to say, you're just going to have to learn to live with that for the rest of your life. So what we're going to look at next is the mistake that Moses makes that he simply has to live with for the rest of his life. And he remembers it. And honestly, if you look at the subtle hints in the text, he's not real happy about it. So let's talk about Sinai as a dividing point for a moment. So you got this ragtag bunch of Hebrews. They're slaves. They don't know how to live as organized people. They don't understand how to be led. They don't know how to function in civil society. So they spend what amounts to 10 months at this Sinai area. Moses meets with God. The people learn how to sort of live as community. They build this tabernacle, which is to be the focal point of their worship and everything. In other words, they turn from a group of disorganized slaves to an organized nation. They arrive at Sinai as slaves and have no idea what to do. They leave Sinai 10 months later as an organized people group. When you're a kid, your parents don't always hold you fully responsible for your actions. When you become an adult, you're held responsible for your actions. Sinai is where the people of Israel are grown up into adulthood. So when they leave Sinai, God is going to look at them as a completely different type of people. And He is going to say, you are responsible for your actions. And Moses, you their leader, you are responsible to lead them properly. You know the story, so the people still behave like children. There's no growing up that takes place on the part of the children. Not enough water, they whine. Not enough food, they whine. The same food day after day, they whine. Instead of looking on the bright side, they look on the dark side about everything. And you can feel this tension gradually rising. It's like if you work in a workplace where every day you're responsible for something and everybody complains about what you do. And year one, you kind of absorb it. And year two, it becomes a little bit more frustrating. What is it like 10 years into that experience and you're still dealing with these whiny, miserable, complainy people every day? And that's Moses. So it kind of reaches ahead. And so there's these various stories, and Moses has to intercede on behalf of the people again and again and again. So we turn over to the 20th chapter. And there's another interesting detail that's introduced here. There's sort of like a leadership troika that takes place here. There's Moses, there's Aaron, and there's Miriam. Miriam is Aaron's sister, and she's sort of like a prophetess. And the three of them kind of work together to lead. Now, Moses is the chief guy, but he relies on these two other people. The people of Israel, the whole congregation, come into the wilderness of Zin in the first month. And the people stayed at Kadesh. And Miriam died there and was buried there. The original leadership team is starting to degrade. That moment has to take a heavy toll on it. And here we come. Now there was no water for the congregation. Can you feel what's coming? It's there. And they assembled themselves together. Now remember, three people in leadership, one has just died. They're still mourning, they're feeling this loss. They're probably wondering what's next. They're frustrated with this whole situation, and here come the people again. Would that you have that we had perished when our brothers had perished before the Lord? Why have you brought this assembly of the Lord into the wilderness? This is like, I mean, you could just do a copy and paste. If you were writing this today, you could just do a copy and paste of this text and keep inserting it. Turn over a few more chapters and paste the text into that. Turn over a few more chapters and paste it in again. It never stops. both we and our cattle, and why have you made us come out into Egypt to bring us to this vile place? It is no place for grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, and there is no water to drink. Then Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly to the entrance of the tent of meeting and fell on their faces. And the glory of the Lord appeared to them. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the staff and assemble the congregation, you and Aaron your brother, and tell the rock before their eyes to yield its water. So you shall bring water out of the rock for them and give drink to the congregation and their cattle." And Moses took the staff from before the Lord as he commanded him. Then Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock, and he said to them, and I cannot possibly put enough emotion into this to do it justice, "Hear now, you rebels, shall we bring water out of this rock for you?" And Moses lifted up his hand and he struck the rock with his staff twice. The instruction was, "Speak to the rock and it will yield water." Moses' response was, And you could almost, and we won't do it here, but you could almost insert a string of expletives here. "You blankety blank 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 rebels, so you want water today? I'm going to show you water." And he grabs the staff that he's supposed to just hold up and speak to the rock, and he wails it into that rock. And just for good measure, just in case you didn't get the message, wham, again. In the minds, do we get Moses' decision? Do we get his emotion? Do we feel it? You bet. If we were there, would we do the same thing? I'm telling you, I probably wouldn't have stopped until there was no staff, until it was toothpicks. And that was a nice lead-in. Because at the end of all this, up until this very moment, this is still his hope. One day we're going to get to the promised land.
That's why God doesn't kill him. There's your consequence. You're going to sit on the outside and watch. If I take you home, you don't learn anything. That's not even painful. To die is gain.
Going to
watch.
And that could be. I'm not going to surmise what God's motivations are and why He does one thing and doesn't do another.
God's consequences when I misbehave are thorough. They have to be. So much of the time when I misbehave and I behave myself into something, I pray for the merciful God. Oh God, be merciful to me. But when it's somebody else, one of my adversaries, oh, I'm praying for that vengeful God.
Okay, so let's quickly read God's response. "And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not believe in me to uphold me as holy in the eyes of the people." And this is really the issue. You represent me. The people can't see me. The people do clearly understand that you are my chosen person. And so in a way, you're me there in that situation. And I don't behave that way. I don't lose my cool and begin to beat rocks with sticks. I don't do that. And so you have done an unjust job of representing me before the people. And I can't ignore that. God is not insensitive to our pain. God is not insensitive to our frustration. It's just that God has to retain His reputation with the people. Okay. "Did not believe in me to uphold me as holy in the eyes of the people of Israel. Therefore, you shall not bring this assembly into the land that I have given them." All right. So Moses responds to this. So we're going to turn over to Deuteronomy. All right, Deuteronomy, just a quick lesson in Deuteronomy. We can say that the book of Deuteronomy is Moses' final address to the people. It's broken up into a number of different individual addresses. It's not as if it necessarily all happened at one time or one day. It recounts their history. It reminds the people of what God expects of them. It's just a grand review. We could say Moses takes the people through the past 40 years of their life, reminds them of everything that's happened, reminds them of what God expects of them. But in the middle of this, see if I can find these. Okay, the third chapter, starting with the 23rd verse. It says, "And I pleaded with the Lord at that time, saying, O Lord, you have only begun to show your servants your greatness and your mighty hand. For what God is there in heaven or earth who can do such works? Please let me go over and see the good land before the Jordan, that good hill country, Lebanon. But the Lord was angry with me because of you, and he would not listen to me. And the Lord said to me, Enough from you, do not speak to me of this matter again." In other words, you're not going in. This is still stuck with him. This is a point of frustration with him. This is the mistake that he's really asking God some years later. Couldn't we really revisit this? Let's talk about this one more time. Now, I know I screwed up, but do you remember the people? Do you remember what they were like? What about them? Couldn't we revisit this decision? Maybe I could just let me put one toe on that side. And God says, enough of this. Okay, now remember, this is the God whom Moses has described as patient. So you got to wonder, how many times before this recorded conversation has a similar conversation taken place between Moses and God where Moses said, "Hey, what do you think? Today would be a good day for you to change your mind. What do you think? I could go into the land just for a little bit." And the answer is always the same. The answer is no. And so God's response, enough from you. Do not speak to me of this matter again. Go up to the top of Pisgah, lift up your eyes westward and northward and southward and eastward and look at with your eyes. You shall not go over this Jordan, but charge Joshua and encourage and strengthen him. And this is actually a tremendous gift. This is actually a tremendous concession gift. You're not going there, but you have personally raised up and trained the man who's going to go there. This is as good as it gets. He is essentially like your son. Your hand-prepared son. It's not his literal biological son, but he is that guy. That guy that has been by his side for years. So this is a pretty big deal. Moses has trained and prepared the guy who's going to go there and represent him. But it's still stuck there. So in the middle of the review, Moses is now talking to the people. "But the Lord has taken you and brought you out of the iron furnace of Egypt to be a people of his own inheritance, as you are this day. Furthermore, the Lord was angry with me." Notice these words here. "Because of you." The Lord was angry with me because of you. "And he swore that I should not cross the Jordan and that I should not enter the land." The good land. The good land. He's loading it on. The good land. "The Lord your God is giving to you for an inheritance. For I must die in this land. I must not go over the Jordan. But you shall go over and take possession of the land." Is this clear, guys? I am going to die here. I am going to die. I am not going to go across to the good land that God has given me. And I am going to die here because God is angry with me because of you. It's really stuck there. This is probably not one of Moses' finer moments. And yet we understand the frustration and the bitterness completely.
I don't understand.
I'll get to you second. Go ahead.
It's really interesting that we see the same thing happen.
And incidentally, and I'm going to come to you next, but I have heard, some of you guys in this room, and let me just be very encouraging here. I have heard some of you guys in this room that I've sat down with one-on-one that have told me I've made some mistakes, and they're my fault, and I'm dealing with the mistakes, and I know I screwed up some stuff. So, for whatever it's worth, I'm commending some of you. I mean, I can think, I know meeting with you, Justin, a number of times where you've said, you know, there's stuff that I've done that have caused certain problems in my life or certain situations, and I did it. And not trying to backpedal and not trying to blame it on somebody else. And there's something really admirable about that. But boy, it can be tough. It can be very tough when you have to look at yourself. It's another one of those lonely moments. I did this. I'm going through this, and I did this to myself.
Yeah, but Moses is looking back, though. He's still stepping out on the precipice here. But I'm looking back, and I'm even looking at God going, this is your fault. You brought me out here with these idiots. You told me to come out here with these whiny crybabies. You put me out here, and then you expect me to not get frustrated and to not hit the rock. I can't cross over because I got a rock once. It's not fair.
He had a choice.
He didn't have to.
It really did not happen to me. And he was ultimately third leader. So if there was a complaint out of the crowd, if there was a problem, he had to deal with it the best way he could. But getting frustrated and saying, well, you're crying about water, well, I'm going to beat the staff on the rock until it water. If you know God didn't say to do that, should have never been. When you let your frustration, your anger get the best of you, that's when you step out of that realm of what God wants best for you.
Here's what we're going to say. I'm going to say that everything that you said is reasonably accurate. That Moses is, you chose me. And here I am. Let's just say that Moses is a real guy just like us. And if we don't want to end up at the end of life being bitter, how are we going to react differently? How are we going to deal with that frustration that could lead to bitterness so that we don't become angry with God because of a situation? Because if you have a call, and we've talked about this before, if God has called you to do something, then even if it's in a much smaller way, you're exactly like Moses. God has called you to step out. God has called you to do something. The inevitable consequence of accepting that call is that life is going to be difficult for you at times.
And I can tell you, because I do this in ministry, everybody's got a better way to do it. Everybody knows more than you do. Everybody thinks that they can...
Okay, Moses. Easy. Easy, Moses.
They can run that. They have a great idea of how to do it.
Dan, would you look under the table and see if there's a staff under there? Because if there is, you need to slide it away from him right now.
Well, no, I'm just saying that, but that's human nature. If you think you can run this family, then you run the family. I'm supposed to be leading here. And you're speaking out against me. I heard from God. It is. And inevitably, it all comes back to, like, at the end, the blame game. This is your fault.
Well, in the end, here's what we'd have to come to the conclusion of.
Responsible for the bad decision.
There is a time when God is going to say no to our request to be delivered from something. So we either learn how to be at peace with that, or we kind of carry that little edge with us for the rest of our life, and I think it will probably tend to contaminate our relationships and infect our ministry from that time forward in some way. So,
scars hurt,
and this is where we come back to what we started with. Can I still rely on the steadfast love of God, and can I accept from God's hand the no's in my life, and know that the no does not mean that God doesn't love me? When God says no to Moses' request one last time to go into the land, it doesn't mean that God doesn't love him personally. It's simply God's answer to his leadership role. So there's times when we have to separate our personal life from our call or our ministry or our responsive role from relationship. They're not the same. And we fuse them together because we as men especially, what do we find our identity in? Almost universally, men find their identity in what they do. And when you tell me I can't any longer do this thing that is so important to me that I think I'm the best at, and you're saying no, I take that not only as a professional rejection, I take that as a personal relational rejection as well. And that's not true.
How would I feel if I was good at something? Really good at it. And my dad said, that's not what you're going to do. You're going to join the army. But I'm really good at this. I don't care. This is what you're going to do. I'm going to have a resentment.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe he's right. Maybe he sees something that I don't. Maybe he sees the fact that the discipline is not there and that the direction is not there. There's a character flaw. So you need to go develop more character before you go do whatever it is that thing that you want to do.